Good morning, members. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the committee. This morning we are having an informational hearing, and I would like to turn it over to Representative Walker for some opening comments and introduction. Ms. Walker.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and members and community members that came here. I first, on the record, want to thank Representative Thiessen, and his willingness to have this informational hearing today, and Jim McNerney for helping get the testifiers. One of my passions has always been out-of-home placement. Before I do that, I should also let the public know we'll have members coming and going. We have several committees going on at the same time. I'm in another committee, too, and they'll be coming to get me for a vote eventually. And so please do apologize. But I wanted to make sure, even though knowing that there would be multiple committees going on and members would be stressed, I wanted something done on this particular issue for the record as I'm exiting the legislature. Woo! That, as I was saying, one of my near and dear issues to my heart is dealing with out-of-home placement, and in particular the disparities of African-American children. And the fact that the disparity seems to just stay as it is, and sometimes it's a little wider, but we aren't doing a lot of aggressive policies around preventing that children going into the out-of-home placement, let alone trying to intervene aggressively and making sure that our families are whole at some point. And so we're going to go back to something that I started when I first got elected in 2001, which was a report on what is going on with the disparities of African-American children and out of the out-of-home placement system in the state of Minnesota. There's been a African-American task force that has been going since 2001, organized by the Department of Human Services, and so we'll get an update on how things are going with there. We'll also find out the state of African-American children in Minnesota and hopefully have some policy ideas and solutions that we can utilize in the upcoming years, because this is a cost to our system, and more importantly, it's a cost to our children and families. So, Madam Chair, we can get started with the testifiers.
Thank you, Representative Walker. Thank you for bringing this to our attention. And I would like to call up the first, Marquita Stevens, is it, from the African American Adoption? You've come. Good morning and welcome to the committee, and thank you for coming.
Thank you very much.
Please state your name for the record and proceed.
Distinguished members of the committee, my name is Marquita Stevens, president of the African American Adoption Agency. And the Center for, the Center for the Study of Social Policy references a Children's Bureau report as follows. The United States child welfare system is embroiled in an epidemic involving race and bad child and family outcomes. African American children and families are significantly more likely to be torn apart by the local child welfare agency than any other racial group in the country, despite the fact that multiple national research studies prove that African American families are not more likely to abuse or neglect their children. In 2000, 37% of the children in the U.S. child welfare system were African American, while totaling some 15% of the child population. This same report ranks the disproportionate number of African Americans in child welfare by individual states. 46 states posted disproportionate representation. Minnesota was fourth from the bottom of the 16 states categorized as extremely disproportionate. The African-American disproportionality ratio for the entire U.S. was 2.43. Minnesota's was 4.77. This data, coupled with empirical observation and practice findings, fuel the dialogue among members of COMAC, the Black Church Coalition, lawyers, psychologists, academics, and child welfare workers throughout the county. That eventually resulted in the presentation to and urging of the legislators 8 years ago to move directly and forcefully on the overrepresentation of African-American children in our home places. This was the beginning of the dialogue that we brought forth to you and the data that we acted on at the time. The 2002 report by the Department of Human Services in Minnesota resulted and formal efforts were underway that the African American Adoption Agency was pleased to participate in as it relates to helping children achieve permanency in their lives. I was not part of the Disparities Committee subsequently formed by DHS to address this issue and cannot therefore speak to the accomplishments of that effort. Others will do that. I can, however, testify that although I have read of a reduction in the percentage of African-American children in out-of-home placement, levels are still not acceptable. And African-American children are still at risk of poor outcomes due to the lack of permanency they seek. Between fiscal year 1999 and 2006, children in foster care waiting to be adopted steadily declined in Minnesota, with the exception of a significant spike in 2003, according to reports by the Administration for Children and Families. Minnesota can further boast the adoption of 29% of African-American children in 2000 and 22% in 2001, according to the same report. The African-American Adoption Agency is proud to be a part of that record of the Minnesota solution. Yet the view of the glass is half full really is only half the story. In a news release by Annie G. Casey Foundation in July of last year, it states, although national trends in overall child well-being have improved slightly since 2000, the differences across racial and ethnic groups are large, and the outcomes for black children are worse on every one of the 10 indicators studied in their new report. The 2007 Kids Count data book, which I would recommend you get, this also looks at the 726,000 children in the U.S. who spend time in foster care each year and calls for a focus on the needs of African American youth. Douglas Nelson, president of the foundation, stated, tragically, the overrepresentation of children of color is evident at all points in the child welfare system. African American children currently remain in foster care for significantly longer periods of time than white children. And once in the foster care system, families of color receive fewer services, have less contact with child welfare workers, and experience lower reunification rates with their families than white children do. In Minnesota, Susan Wells reported her research findings to the African American Disparity Advisory Committee in 2005, which I did attend, as I was a member of her advisory committee at the U of M. In the synopsis of the annotated bibliography on child welfare regarding this study, it states that regarding disproportionality, findings suggest the disproportionality in reporting and possibly in screening cases and in the wait for adoption. In the study of neglect cases, differential treatment occurred at the point at which a worker would determine whether or not an investigation was warranted. For example, in cases in which maternal drug abuse was involved, the case was more likely to be investigated when the child was African American. This sentiment was echoed somewhat by Tim Morton in 1999 when he wrote, multiple factors contribute to the variance in child maltreatment. Income, research stats, higher rates of African Americans reported, African American referrals investigated at higher rates, and decisional bias and allegation determination. This is indeed the other half of the glass. All of this points to the complexity of the problem and the need to discontinue business as usual. I believe we have to move to a viewpoint that connects the varying disparities that affect this population, effectively ending the silo approach to achieving satisfactory outcomes for our state's most vulnerable. I rarely have occasion to quote George Wills, but in his article Friday in the Washington Post, he referenced the Moynihan Report,
which asserts that schools cannot compensate for the disintegration of families and hence communities, the primary transmitters of social capital. I do not believe we can continue to look at the problem of children in out-of-home placement without seriously connecting it to the problems in incarceration rates, health, education, economics, and other disparities affecting African-American people. Children live in families, and families in communities. And to not understand that is to minimize the value of the social capital that we all trade in on as we grow and mature. The African American Adoption Agency has done some work to assist in easing this particular stress on the state, which he and while heeding the cry of the community through its Community Caring for Its Children program. We seek to reduce the number of people being reported to child welfare by expanding parental capacity in a voluntary response of the community and extended family. This effort is aimed to educate the black public about ways it can help families in duress rather than seek government intervention as its first response. For those who are unfamiliar with us, we are the only agency that has as a mission the permanency of African American and other children of color in the state of Minnesota from foster care in particular. Our work in this area has been significant, yet we can do more. Before you is a calendar. The calendar of children that have taken a leap of faith in stepping forward and making it known that they want to be adopted. Each of them is an example of children that stay in care longer and endure multiple placements. Budget cuts to these services of the county impact these kids. Since the disparity issue is most visible in children coming into the county child welfare system, and we know African American and American Indian children stay in care longer, cutting services at the back end penalizes these kids more because they stay longer. So when you're looking at budget cuts, and you inevitably will, remember who's hurting as a result. Post this calendar on your wall so that each month you'll see a child. The problem really seems to be getting agreement on how you measure success, giving varying perspectives on this issue. Let me highlight a few of the children in lieu of their actual physical testimony here in this child-specific recruitment project, which, by the way, was funded by DHS as an innovative approach that has been very well received in the community. One of the SIBs has had 13 placements between them in the 4 years they've been in foster care. Currently in the care of a skilled foster parent, and can now put permanency as a viable option for themselves, all of whom are under 11. Tina has had 10 placements in 2 years, but is settling in and wants to be adopted. Another 11-year-old is an outstanding student, but displays a trauma common to someone with his experience of abuse and neglect. He has been in and out of home placement for 6 years. Shall we give up on him? Still another has had 19 placements, an excellent artist. How about him? All of them have been removed for neglect. Chemical dependency and mental health are the common contributors to neglect in the case of these children. Two of them for sexual abuse. But all of them can be helped. I see it every year at our holiday party, a room full of kids with the same kind of start in life, running, laughing, having fun. And also having something that these kids in this calendar don't have, a permanent place to call home. Not only can it be done, it is being done. Have we solved the problem? Of course not. Is it better? It depends. When compiling these remarks, I was reminded of the story that you've all heard of the person walking on the beach throwing starfish into the ocean one by one. When asked what difference she expected to make, given all the starfish that had been washed ashore, undaunted, she replied that if she picked up another and threw it back into the ocean, it makes a difference to that one. In a Hennepin County unit, the recruitment numbers for March 08 tally 115 kids. 81 are either full African American or biracial with one parent as an African American. All but 10 of the 115 kids are children of color. This is March 08. 91%. Remember, they stay in care longer. In Ramsey County, they state in their ending racism report that 4% of the kids in Ramsey County are African American for 20% of their caseload, of the out-of-home placement. Disparity, disproportionality still exists at unacceptable levels all along the continuum of service. But does that mean you should stop being concerned because the problem seems so big? No. Why not? You've got 13 reasons in front of you. Pick them up, because your caring will make a difference to that one. Thank you for your time. And go with me.
Well, thank you, Ms. Stevens, for your very compelling testimony. If you want to wait just a minute and stay there, we may have some questions for you, if you'll take questions.
Oh, sure.
There might be any members. Representative Outwald.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the testifier, I very much appreciate your testimony as well. I found it interesting. I think there is common ground, even with George Will. And I thought his quote, there are many of us here on a bipartisan basis who I think support strengthening the family, and that ultimately when we look at these problems in society and problems for government, so much of it seems to go back to the breakdown in the family. Do you have any suggestions for us about how we can get at, what are some ways we can get at that breakdown in the family that leads to these out-of-home placements?
Yes, Stephen.
Thank you. Some of the solutions are within our control, some of them aren't, quite frankly. We start at the point of providing education to the public, to people who are concerned about this issue, to let them know ways that they can intervene in families, in family contexts when they see them in distress. And try to make those social connections so that there is support for one another within the confines of the community itself. This can happen. We piloted it a couple of times through a few churches, and it was met with much success. There is strong interest on the part of the community to step in and help if they know what to do. And so we start there. Certainly there's a need, I believe, for a cross-industry or interdisciplinary, if you will, focus on this issue. And that's why I call for a relationship between those in criminal justice and those in health disparity, who's working on health disparity issues, et cetera, to get together, because all of it impacts the family. And so you have the same population moving from service to services. So we need to all get together and look at some kind of comprehensive approach so that we can address the symptoms rather than just the presenting problem. Our emphasis is on keeping kids safe and providing adequate coverage and actually enabling kids to thrive within the context of family and their own community. And this can be done, we believe, quite strongly on a voluntary basis, that people will step up. A lot of times, everybody doesn't want to adopt the child, but they will help out.
Mm-hmm.
They will help support. Mm-hmm. And so it's trying to make those connections. And we think we have a unique way of presenting that as from an African-American perspective of an agency that's been functioning in that way for several years in the community and recognized as such. I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Yes, there are certainly things we can't do. We take a much wider economic stimulus package than what we're able to present and to help.
Thank you for that answer. Representative Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Stevens, because you've been a part of this, and members, I did do an opening, and I said just do another, just quick, since there's more individuals in the room. I was the individual that moved the wanting to do the report from the community, having heard from the community and wanting to look at the disparities of out-of-home placement for African-American children in 2001, thinking that, you know, hearing there was a lot of rhetoric at the time talking about African-American parents were just, in general, bad parents compared to our counterparts, which I believe is not true.
That's right.
Also, wanting to know if there was a part of the system that was truly broken that we could get at and fix. And one of the things, and we'll hear from some folks later, that wasn't the case after hearing the report. It's just a little bit at a time. So the disparity went an individual makes that initial phone call and how the police react and how the social workers react. There's a disparity if the child goes to St. Joe's versus staying at home right away. There's a disparity in who's able to have a private attorney versus not have a private attorney. There's a disparity in the type of case plan the individual has and how a Caucasian family may look at a particular situation versus an African-American family. There's just a disparity through the entire system, getting with the courts and the judges, and then by the time you get through the entire system, the disparities is just so wide, it just seems unreachable. But Ms. Stevens, my question to you, as we move forward as a legislature, whether it is reductions, hopefully, that will never come on a federal level with targeted case management, with limited budgets, and it's one of the things that this is an area where not a lot of people work on, and so we all have issues that we work on and prioritize, and so this is one that falls to the side because it's not necessarily an immediate concern for most. Whose responsibility, because right now children that are in the out-of-home placement, while our counties are responsible for them, they still the state's responsibility overall. They're state children, especially once the rights are terminated. Whose responsibility is it to continue to monitor and work towards, in your opinion, eliminating or decreasing the disparities that we have in the out-of-home placement with African-American children? And do you have any suggestions on how we can do that?
Can I we have a quorum now, so I'm just going to call the meeting order.
Sure, Mr. Chair.
I got to go. Go ahead.
I have varying opinions on that question. I would say, from my vantage point, you always need an independent, objective party, part of whatever mechanism or group you put together. There is a mechanism of quarterly administrative review for children who are in foster care. And I believe that there should be, as part of that group, an independent person, someone who's not a community person, someone who's not directly connected with the case, because that person can bring the point of view to be able to see, you know, what's missing. I mean, you just bring a different analysis when you're not just in that particular case. You're vested in your love for children or for some other altruistic motivation. And I think that would be very helpful to the process, to strengthen the current process. I don't necessarily think we need a whole nother process. I think there's some processes in place that could be strengthened.
Mr. Chair.
Reverend Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Stevens, what I'm hearing is, so, for example, right now, we have the Department of Human Services that is really is supposed to be held accountable in monitoring what's going on in our out-of-home placement system for all of our children in the state. And currently, we have some staff within the department that is looking at the disparities and working with the task force. As a community person, especially with the African American Adoption Agency, is there something in particular, you know, when I go into classrooms, I use my miracle wand, you know, I'm like, you know, if you could just have one wand and you could do whatever, and money you can't get, my miracle wand doesn't do money, we can do policy. What would that miracle wand be for you? And I'm going to ask you with the miracle wand, if you could figure out how to use a miracle wand to either eliminate or decrease this crisis that we have, how would you use your wand to help our children?
Ms. Stevens.
I think I agree with some of the points of view of the researchers that I quoted in that much of the disparity occurs
prior to the kid coming in, is at the decision point of the kid coming in to the system. And so you would need to focus some attention, some significant attention at that point. So that's all of the places that you mentioned there. All of this, the decision point, the schools, the police, you know, all of the mandated reporting. Those who are in hospital emergency rooms, all of the places where they decide whether or not to file a report. There's some work that needs to be done there so that they can begin to see things different than they have been. And I think you'll see the disparity rate impacted as a result of that. You'll either find that you'll get more cases reported because underreporting is what's happening, or you'll see a drop in the number of African-American kids and American Indian kids that are reported because they now understand within the cultural context of other people what's going on in that family, and they can interpret it differently. One of the two will happen, but I think education and some work and training, the work really needs to be put in that arena. You'll find a impact on your numbers if you do that. Once in the system, I think we have to increase efforts to normalize, to the extent possible, the whole adoption and foster care process. It's difficult in some respects to recruit for kids because we still want to maintain confidentiality, and I call it secrecy, around the family. We can't have it both ways. You know, if you want to recruit, you have to talk. So I think, in large part, the reason why you're on this treadmill is because you tie your own hands. And so you need some work there in terms of protecting the privacy of the children, but creating a point of view in society that normalizes adoption and foster care. I know that one of the kids in the calendar happens to go to a school that my son attends, and once he and some other kids, because the calendar was circulated there, found out about the kid being in foster care, they responded to him much differently. They embraced him. They're, oh, wow, you know, I didn't know that. And he invited me. He became, you know, much more noticed, less invisible, and certainly accepted by those kids. So I think our process around how much people know about a kid being in foster care or being adopted is probably overstated. I think there's some work that needs to be done there. And then, of course, each internal administration at the county and state levels that have jurisdiction over this have to examine themselves and decide whether or not they are operating at optimum performance in order to get the kind of outcomes that are necessary. We have to hold them accountable, perhaps it's this body or or some like body that holds them responsible for reporting on their progress on regular intervals so that you can keep up with whether or not we're winning or losing. I think you putting concern and effort into wanting to hear about this, setting aside time on regular intervals to hear about it, would make a big difference. Those are just things that I think in a policy or in a non-fiscal way, you can probably make some impact on the numbers in out-of-home experience for African-American other children of color, as well as their experience in outcomes. So one thing to be in it is another thing to have a bad experience with. And so while foster care is designed to be temporary and not permanent, and there's all kinds of issues related to just growing up in a temporary state, nevertheless, we can try to create the best experience in that environment as you can.
Can I just follow up, Bruce, on that one? You talked about the mandated reporters and educate them to on what specifically, I guess, would be the question. Go ahead.
On
what's reportable, what should be reported and what's not. For example, if I'm in a school and a kid, and you have to look at the pattern of zip codes in the report, and then you'll see whether or not there's an understanding or misunderstanding. That, assuming you've done that, if I'm in a school and there's kids, a certain kid comes to school all the time improperly dressed in the way. In a certain environment, I will call Cop Texas because the kid is coming to school improperly dressed, and I think that there's an issue there and it needs to be investigated. In another context in the school, they will reach into the lost and found box, give them a coat, hat, glove, whatever they're missing, send them home with a note and say, you know, if you need it, keep it. If you don't, wash it and bring it back.
So it's trained to be able to exercise discretion.
That's right.
Okay.
What's really a reportable offense of what? What can you handle within the corporate context in this event?
President Gottwald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Stevens, I know, frankly, Representative Walker, what I would do with that magic wand that you were offering before. I think the answer, certainly from my perspective, would be to build stronger, healthier families. Now, there's a lot to that, and you can't just wave a magic wand and do it, but that would be the big one. But, Ms. Stevens, I'm aware that we have an Office of Minority and Multicultural Health that's working to eliminate some of the disparities you addressed in your testimony. Is there coordination between your agency and that office? Has there been cooperation in that area, or could we benefit from more of that?
I think there's a benefit from it. We haven't. We tend to function in silo format, all of us. Mm-hmm. And that's what I call for, is more of a collaboration amongst all of us who impact the same population. But heretofore, there isn't, that I know of, or that I've been in, a system-wide kind of a response or a collaboration among private providers.
Representative
Gottwald, except for a couple of the community folks, groups that receive some of the health disparity dollars, a lot of the focus around the Minority Health Department is eliminating with these projects across the state in the different communities around the different areas that were legislated for them to do so. There's a couple of the groups that do cross issue work, if you want to say. But the majority of them, the way that they were already working, they're working on health things or, you know, reducing the amount of high blood pressure that's in the community, and not necessarily as nurses working on out-of-home placement. And so not everyone is working on similar issues, but I do think there's a couple of the organizations that do cross work, but not all of them.
Representative Fox.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Stevens. Wanted to follow up regarding the issue of a couple of the cases you mentioned, individuals, young people. You mentioned, you know, 6 out-of-home placements, 19 out-of-home placements for the young artists. Both from yourself but other testifiers who may be coming up. You talked about we want to aim for adoption, but at least we want to have a quality foster care experience if we don't achieve that. If you could briefly give us the contributing factors to why we have multiple. I mean, I could imagine, you know, 2 or 3 for various reasons, you know, initial one to the more permanent one, et cetera. Is it about the children? Is it about the type of foster homes available? You know, what is it for those of that are not very familiar with this area? What's leading to such large numbers of out-of-home placements for child rather than a more permanent foster experience prior to trying to have that adoption experience?
There's so many multiple placements in it. It varies. It could be both the child's behavior or the something happening with the foster family. I think there's some specifics around that I would defer to county workers who are going to testify later. They can tell their opinion. And I know Lynn is going to be talking later, and she can talk about that from the Hennepin County perspective, not just playing to, but add that to your list. But they have firsthand knowledge of it, and I'd rather tell her story.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you for coming today.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
If I may just make a comment, back to my question about the Office of Minority and Multicultural Health. Now, I understand they've got a budget of about $100 million, and they have people from many minority groups on their staff. You know, it may be worthwhile for us, you know, whether this is a hearing that's supposed to help inform us for policy in the future, but it may help to look at the capabilities of that office and whether or not they can be used more broadly to help in these situations.
Did you say $100 million?
$100 million. I understand that.
Wait.
No, no. Well,
wait. Paul had it. Sorry.
My understanding is that's a combination of federal and state dollars, but they got $100 million, and if we can leverage that, that would be helpful.
No, Mr. Chair, Representative Emmer, yes, I am uptight. I'm a little tired today. But, you know, I'm not going to be here, so I seen some light bulbs like there was money. And I just wanted to make sure that, you know, yes, there is $100 million, and yes, it's a combination because we put some money, we got some federal matching dollars. But the majority of the money goes towards eliminating in 7-8 particular areas that are costing our systems quite a bit of money because of the disproportionate amount of disparities in health care. But Representative Gottwald's point is valid, especially since, I'll use an example, the African American Storytellers is a group that has gotten money in the past that is working on, got some money around eliminating disparities in the African American community. They also do storytelling around out of home, but they do a wide variety of community work on different projects. They fit. Some of them would never fit because of the types of work that they do, but it's something to look into. It's just that $100 million is good money being utilized right now, and so just wanted to make sure that folks know that wasn't good money to touch for anything else.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, my intent was not to suggest that we raid it or that it's not being used properly, but that perhaps with those kinds of resources and staff, we might find ways of addressing some of these areas.
Aaron Sullivan Sutton. Thank you for coming. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself if you could.
Members, my name is Erin Sullivan Sutton. I'm the Director of the Division of Child Safety and Permanency at the Department of Human Services, and I welcome the opportunity to talk with you today. Ms. Stevens is a hard act to follow. As you know, you directed the department to convene an advisory committee in 2001 to look at the issues with respect to the high numbers of African-American children in out-of-home care. And you directed us to look at the decision points that lead to different outcomes for children. And so we began our work in 2001 and submitted a report to you in 2002. The committee, as you saw in the report, was comprised of a number of leaders in the African-American community, a number of mental health providers, county members, as well as other stakeholders. I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the report, but I'll highlight a few components and then talk to you about some of the work that has occurred over the past several years, as well as a glance at what the data will tell us today in terms of whether any of this work is making a difference or where we need to continue to put our efforts.
And can I just ask a question? Is this the report that you, yeah.
The report that we submitted to you is in your packet.
Okay, thank
you. Titled Study of Outcomes for African American Children in Minnesota's Child Protection System. The report indicates that as a percentage of the population, African American children were five times more likely to be in out-of-home care. African American children were more likely to be reported for neglect, 80% for African-American children in out-of-home care, to 64% of the Caucasian children reported to the system for neglect. African-American children at that time were two times more likely to be placed in out-of-home care for reasons related to the parents. I should note that children are in placement in Minnesota either for reasons related to the parents in generally about half the time, in about 50% of the instances, children are out of home care as a result of their own disability or behavior. And our population here, for purposes of the report, we studied on child protection and parent reasons. As Ms. Stevens noted, disproportionality or disparity begins at the reporting of alleged child maltreatment. Once those reports are received, the county makes a determination as to whether to conduct an assessment. At the time of the report, African-American children were assessed at a rate of 83.3 per 1,000 African-American children in Minnesota's population, as compared to Caucasian children being assessed at a rate of 13.3 per 1,000 Caucasian children in the Minnesota population. We looked at a number of key decision points in the child protection system, and as Representative Schlosser indicated, you can see disparities or disproportionality affected and altered along those decision points. The first is the report to child protection in the first instance. We see, as I mentioned, significant disproportionality at the very onset. And the second key decision point is whether a report is accepted for assessment or not. The third is whether the agency makes a determination of maltreatment. Fourth is whether the family is referred for ongoing child protection services, whether provided by the agency or community agency. Fifth is the decision to place the child in out-of-home care, and finally, permanency decisions for children who are in placement. As indicated by Ms. Stevens and Representative Walker, several national studies have clearly found that African-American families do not abuse or neglect their children at a higher rate than Caucasian families. That simply does not occur. And so we needed to look at why those disparities, and can we alter what happens when families are reported to the system so that we don't make those disparities worse. The committee had recommendations in primarily four areas. First was monitoring and evaluating county practices to eliminate disparities and to continue to look at disparities along each of those decision points. That we needed to emphasize culturally conscious training and innovative service strategies to better meet the needs of African American families coming to the attention of our system. To work in partnership with the African American community and to use the strengths and leadership skills in the community to address the issues. And finally, the need for advocacy for supports needed by African American families to ensure that children are able to grow up in safe nurturing homes. We recognize through that process that we all have a responsibility to eradicate this overrepresentation of African-American children in out-of-home care. And as all of you know, the out-of-home care experience in and of itself is traumatic. And so we really need to focus our attention to ensure that we're not creating further trauma for African-American children by the mere fact of placement. We recognize the need to balance traditional self-focused mandates of child protection policy with the societal need to help to support healthy family functioning and support. Across the country, including in Minnesota, we had a child protection system that focused so narrowly on the child that we oftentimes did further damage by not recognizing that the well-being of children was dependent on the well-being of their families. After completing the report, the work did not stop there. During this process, we worked with the four counties having the largest African-American populations in their communities, those being, of course, Hennepin County, Ramsey County, Anoka County, and Olmsted County. Each of the four counties has implemented a number of strategies to address disparities within their own communities, and you will hear from two of those today, so I won't go into detail in all the work that's being done locally. But I can tell you that the counties have worked pretty aggressively over the past several years to address bias and disparities in their own communities and to work with the community members to do this work. As part of the committee process, the counties have come together to share information and strategies on what's working and what's not working, so it continues to be a cross-community learning experience. Another item that the African American Committee addressed, which resulted from the report, was to conduct a case review in four counties to assess the appropriateness of decision making, including the level and types of services. And Dr. Susan Wells from the University of Minnesota was instrumental in that work, in which she reviewed 206 neglect cases comparing what occurred with respect to Caucasian children reported for child neglect and African-American children reported for child neglect, and the students referred to some of that, so I won't go into further detail. The source of disparity was not found in the analysis. However, there were, as noted, differences in the dynamics of case practice based on race. The report by Dr. Wells has recommended targeting attention for potential bias in the child protection system, as well as continued special focus and attention to case processes and decisions, similar to what we looked at in the 2002 report. And if people are interested in looking at that more detail about the report, it's found on the department's website or the University of Minnesota School of Social Work website. At the same time, work was going on to address disparities in out-of-home placement. Minnesota was undergoing a sea change in statewide redesign of our child protection system, which was authorized by the legislature in 1999 and initiated on a pilot basis in 2020 counties. We were restructuring the process of responding to families reported to child protection, oftentimes for reasons of poverty, and recognition that the very system that was designed to protect children really was designed to focus on those situations where children were reported to be seriously abused by their caretakers. Those types of cases are just a fraction of the cases reported to child protection. And yes, we do have to have a responsibility to intervene very aggressively in those cases to ensure the protection of children. But most families who are reported to the child protection system are reported for reasons of neglect, approximately 60%, or other lower risk factors, and yet the process for responding to families was the same. We needed to refocus our whole child protection system to have a process that was more responsive to the families coming to our attention and was much more supportive of families caring safely for their children and was focused on the strengths of families and not looking at deficits that families have. This was called family assessment. At the time it was called alternative response, and many of you have heard about that. By 2004, all 87 counties in Minnesota implemented alternative response to family assessment. There was intensive retraining of staff in the child protection system that occurred over the years. And I should note that we contracted with the Institute of Applied Research, who conducted an independent study of alternative response, and the redesign has been very successful. The researchers followed families for a period of 6 years. Children were kept safe the sooner with this process. Families felt much more supported and helped through this process, and placements have in fact been reduced. Today, about 60% of the cases coming to the attention of child protection do receive a family assessment, so we're moving, we believe, in the right direction there. At the same time that has been going on, a number of counties as well as the state and a number of community providers have really been focusing and working to identify and implement and evaluate intervention strategies that are much more responsive to the needs of families and that produce measurable outcomes. I mentioned family assessment. We also have a more structured process for assessing safety risks and family strengths and needs, with an emphasis on agencies really focusing on looking what strengths families bring to the table. Also have done a lot of work on relative search and engaging broader family systems in decision-making, as well as caring for children who may need to be removed from their parents for a period of time. There's been a lot of work done in what we call family group decision-making, which is a concerted effort to bring a number of family members or people that families identify as their support to the table to discuss, sometimes for hours, what are the issues the family is experiencing and how can we support this family and make decisions. That takes a lot of work and a lot of time, but the outcomes are very promising and we believe helpful for children. This is really about reforming our system so we're engaging with families about caring for their children as opposed to government coming in and doing something to families. Since that time, the department, working with many of others, has published a number of practice tools to help counties do the work. One is a relative search best practice guide that has been published and put on our website. We also have developed, and actually developed by one of our supervisors, Maxie Rockymore, who's in the audience, a practice guide for working with African American families in the child welfare system, which really provides good concrete information on how you might approach and what things you might ask African American families, and how to look for the strengths in the African American families and communities in doing this work.
And that one's in our packet.
That is in your packet as well. As I mentioned earlier, one of the big issues has been the issue of the significant disproportionality in reporting on the onset. And we had 87 systems for accepting those calls, and we did not until recently have statewide screening criteria. And one of the things that you have in your packet is statewide guidance for screened reports of child maltreatment that was published in 2007, I believe. In that screening guideline, we also tried to address head-on the issue of poverty and the impact on of poverty in terms of the child maltreatment reporting system, both to provide information to mandated reporters, but also to clarify that under Minnesota law, the definition of neglect means failure to provide a child basic care when reasonably able to do so. If a parent is unable to meet a certain need because they don't have the financial means to do that, the direction for the agency ought to be to provide those services to the family and help them meet their child's needs, but not find a family neglect. And we will be measuring the impact and whether we see any change, both in terms of reports to the maltreatment system as well as reports or determinations made by agencies over time as these screen guidelines are implemented. But we hope that that, again, is a move in the right direction. In May, we expect to be releasing a web-based training for mandated reporters that has been in the works for a number of months. Again, there we will address the issue in correlation with poverty. We also, of course, continue to provide training and cultural competency in the core child welfare training that's required of all new social workers in the system, as well as other courses related to understanding poverty and the role of poverty in child welfare. And with that, I'd like to share with you, if I can pass out some information. I didn't pass this out earlier because people would be have their nose in the data before we were able to lay the context. But in preparing for this morning and in reviewing the 2002 report, one of the questions I thought you might have, and I certainly had, was, so has anything changed since we did the report in 2002? And so what I'm going to share with you as soon as it's passed out is a comparison of the items that we looked at in 2002 compared to what we see in our statewide data for 2006, which is the most current yearly data we have available. We will be having the 2007 data fairly soon, but we don't have it yet. And what we see is some good news, some bad news, and some areas that point to the need for continued work. Hopefully there are copies available and the copies to be shared by members of the audience. On the first page, what you will see is some data with respect to child maltreatment and placement comparison. Between 2000 and 2006, the number of African American children assessed in total per thousand has increased by 7.6%. But the ratio of assessments per population has remained fairly constant. And what this really tells us is that the disproportionality of African American children being reported to the child protection system and accepted for assessment has remained constant from 2000 to 2006. That has not changed. Now, if you look at items B and E, read those kind of together, what this tells us is that between the years 2000 and 2006 is when we had the change to child protection and family assessment. What we see today is that in 2006, African-American families have equal access to a family assessment as well as equally likely to be assigned for traditional investigation, which is, of course, a positive thing. Between years, item C, the differences in both races.
Representative Walker.
Ms. Sullivan Sutton, you just said equal access. Is that by proportion? Or is that, okay.
So that's E and F on this?
No, B and E. It's B and E.
B and E, right.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah, and one of the things that we were very careful to look at with the development of alternative responses family assessment is that there was equity in terms of who had access to that strength-based support and services and who might not. Now, we do see, well, I'll get into in just a moment, an issue related to that, who gets services following that assessment.
I just still want to make sure that I'm very clear because I got two different sets of numbers to the B and E. Because I'm looking at B and E and it matches up, but then when I look at A and there's that disproportionate amount, how does that factor into the numbers that you're referring to now?
For all families who are accepted in assessments or assessment or investigation, African American families are as likely to receive a FAST family assessment as a Caucasian family, and in relation to their population, as the same is true for traditional.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Sullivan Sutton, so it's as likely, but you still don't take into account of the disproportionate numbers between.
I'm getting my data expert.
Yeah.
So once someone is, there's a difference in getting referred.
First,
once someone gets in, they're referred.
They're likely to be 50-50 pretty much, except for that still doesn't take into the account the disproportionate amount of folks that are brought into the system. Okay.
Between years, item C, the differences, there's been a reduction in the number of determinations for both white children as well as African-American children, which is to be expected given that we reform the system and in family assessment cases we don't make determinations of maltreatment. But of the children assigned to traditional investigation, African-American children are still more likely to receive a maltreatment determination in 2006. However, the difference has been reduced from 10.4% in 2000 to 5.7% in 2006. So the disparity is going down, but it still exists. In item D, the number of children referred for ongoing services has increased. In 2000, only about a third of the children were referred for ongoing child protection after investigation. In 2006, that number has increased to about 50%. African-American children are more likely referred for ongoing child protection post-investigation, and white children were more likely referred to CPS post-family assessment. And I'm going to jump to item F because that these are related. As I said, in 2006, white children were more likely to be referred for child protection post-family assessment. However, what is not here is a practice in Hennepin County that is actually a very positive practice in Hennepin County. In their family assessment work, they have contracted with community-based agencies to work with families to provide services. So actually a county child protection worker and a community-based agency worker goes to the home, and the county worker focuses on the issue of risk and safety, and the community-based worker focuses on the issue of services, and that data is not part of the information system. So it's not a complete picture here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to do a clarification, but before I do that clarification, Hennepin County was moving towards that, but however, several of those community contracts have not been renewed because of funding barriers in this coming cycle. So just note that. I'm trying to make sure, I just lost my question. Oh, because we're on, who is this on E? No, F. F. Those children that you just talked about, I just lose my thought because I started thinking about Hennepin County. Hold on 1 second. Here we go. Can you give an example of some of the post family assessment examples that a family may end up in having to do longer than the counterpart of the Caucasian family?
Yes, it may be a family who needs services longer than, say, for example, 90 days, or in Hennepin County, I believe it's 30 days. So a decision is made to open a case for case management to provide longer-term services to families.
An example of services.
you want an example of services?
Example of the type of services that we're talking about, because not all members are familiar with out-of-home placement in this committee, even though it's our
preview. It could be a variety of services, and I'll let the counties go into more detail, but it may be family preservation sorts of services, it may be counseling services, mental health services, maybe chemical health services, it may be services to help them develop skills to, you know, to organize their families to do their work.
So this is for the parents?
This is for the parents.
Yeah. Okay. And just one other question on the data. The numbers in C and D are higher because they're coming out of a... There's already been a different decision made whether to send them to family assessment versus traditional investigation. And typically the traditional investigation would lead to more questions of maltreatment, just because an earlier decision was made that it's more likely that
right,
there's
so
more serious issues.
The number of determinations has decreased because the number of cases getting a traditional investigation has decreased.
Yeah, but this, and the numbers just show actually an increase in percentages, but that's only because it's taken a percentage of the people that are sent to traditional investigation as opposed to the larger universe. Okay. So there actually has been a decrease overall in the number of cases of maltreatment determination.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
And there continues to be a disparity with African American, but that disparity has decreased in that time. The percentage of children placed in out-of-home care during a child protection assessment, whether it's a family assessment or a traditional investigation, has remained relatively stable from 2000 to 2006. However, African American children are still more likely to be placed. Again, here is an area where the disparity has narrowed by 2%, but still exists. On the next page is some data with respect to out-of-home placement. Here we will see an increase in two areas in the gap and a decrease in one area. Between 2000 and 2006, the rate per thousand of children in out-of-home care has decreased for both African-American and Caucasian children. However, African-American children in 2006 have continued to be over six times more likely to spend some time in out-of-home care than white children. And that should be an item that continues to be alarming to us. Under item I, what you see is the reunification rate for African American and Caucasian children are essentially the same. However, the children are unified in less than 12 months. There's a slight reduction in the gap between African American and white children. So it's moving in the right direction, but still needs to go further. Another area that is an area of concern, and Ms. Stevens referred to this issue in her testimony, is the time to adoption. While both white and African-American children have shown an improvement in the time to adopt from 2000 to 2006, the difference between the two groups has, in fact, increased from 8% in 2000 to 21% in 2006, indicating that white children are adopted more frequently in less than 24 months. And again, that's an area of concern and an area that we collectively will need to continue to focus efforts. On the third page, we have some data with respect to children who are under state guardianship and adoption comparison. These are children where there's been a termination of parental rights. The number of children who come into state guardianship has increased by 38% for African-American children and 28% for white children from 2000 to 2006. And as you know, in the past several years, there have been significant changes at both the federal and state level to ensure that children who cannot be reunified with their families have some sort of alternative permanency found for them. Between these years, African-American children continue to be over seven times more likely to come into state guardianship than white children. The disparity rate was 7.1 times more likely for African-American children in 2000, and that is, in fact, increased to 7.8% in 2006. Again, here is an area of concern because there's been a decline in the number of African-American children who were adopted compared to a slight increase in the number of white children who are adopted. and there has been a lot of concerted efforts to increase the adoption of African American children, such as the work that is done by Ms. Stevens' adoption organization and others, but we need more attention in this area to ensure that those children have the opportunity for permanent families in their life. And finally, the number of days weighing between a termination of parental rights and adoption. Again, here we see the reductions for Caucasian children as well as African American children, but the difference between the two groups continues to increase. So while there's good news and kids are waiting less, the bad news is that African American kids are waiting longer. So again, that's an area that we need to continue to focus and attention on. And with that, I would be happy to respond to any questions.
Okay. First of all, I just got a note from the Department of Health that their Office of Minority and Multicultural Health budget is $8 million. So I don't know what the distinction is there, but Representative Walker.
You guys can find $92 million and give them to them. Mr. Chair, I will try to hold back some of my questions, but there are a few that I do want to get to. I do want to thank Ms. Sullivan Sutton for her testimony and give a special plug to Ms. Rocky Moore, who got her good foundation in a good area, Southside, to make sure that she was able to. So she does have that base foundation of the work that she does do for the department. I'm interested in a few different things. One, some recent data, hopefully, that we have for the breakdown of the ages, especially for 8 and under, compared to 13 and over, of those that are either in the out-of-home placement system or have already had their TPR happen. I'm also interested in getting that same question that I gave to you, to Ms. Stevens, and before I do that question, I think the first question to make sure that everybody knows the responsibility. What is the responsibility of the department as it relates to the children in out-of-home placement, period, for the state of Minnesota?
The department does have, by federal law and state law, responsibility for supervising the placement of children in out-of-home care and for achieving improved outcomes and meeting federal standards with respect to safety, permanency, and the well-being of children who are in our child welfare system. We recently had a federal, what they call a child and family services review, where the federal government comes in and does an assessment of each state's child welfare system. That is a fairly lengthy process. There was a long self-assessment component done, and then in September, the federal government and a number of actual case reviewers from other states came to Minnesota and reviewed 50 cases to look at our performance with respect to those items that I mentioned in three counties, Hennepin, Washington, and Carlton County. We do not have the completed report yet. I continue to be told it's on the way. But what I can tell you is we are not meeting the federal standards in a number of areas, particularly with respect to the permanency of children in out-of-home care, as well as the number of times kids re-enter out-of-home care. This is a particular challenge for us in Minnesota, and we will be working with counties and other people. We have a group that's working with us to develop a program improvement plan, and if we do not improve our performance, then we face fiscal penalties. But more importantly than the fiscal penalties are really, how do children fare when they come to the attention of the system?
Mr. Chair.
President Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Sullivan Sutton, what is the role of the department as it relates to, I know you've been working with the counties and trying to improve systems and outcomes in this area. What is the responsibility of the department as it relates to holding counties accountable for improving the outcomes, especially as it relates to decreasing the amount of disparities of African-American children in out-of-home placement, and what types of things have been done as consequences in the past?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, while we have broad supervisory authority, we don't have the ability to do direct intervention in individual cases, although sometimes we are called upon to do that. We have implemented a quality assurance process in Minnesota where we do a what we call a child family services review in each of our 87 counties. We've done that over the past 4 years, and we're now relooking at making some adjustments to that process so that we could spend more time and energy in reviewing counties' performance in our counties that have the largest population and just in how we allocate resources. As a part of that, each county who does not meet the federal standards on any given performance item will develop a program improvement plan and will work to improve their performance, and they report to us on a quarterly basis. We also have something on our information system that's called charting and analysis that we encourage counties to use, and counties do use that, and it provides the opportunity to look at a number of performance items that they can break down by race and ethnicity so that it's an item to continually monitor. It's something that we address in our annual report to the legislature that we do, the state child welfare report. What we do not have is specific authority to impose consequences on counties with respect to disparities. We do have authority to withhold or to impose fiscal sanctions should a county fail to develop or implement a program improvement plan. We have never had the reason to use that sanction authority over the years. Our experience, for the most part, although not all 87 counties are equally cooperative, for the most part, when we go in and review a county, they're doing that review with us, and they want to see where it is that they're doing well and where they're not doing so well. So they, for the most part, have really rallied around that process.
Mr. Schrader, just a couple more questions. Members, thank you, Mr. Schrader. I hope you bear with me. You know, because I have been involved with Ms. Sullivan Sutton in the department for quite a bit of years. We've actually worked on several different pieces of legislation that, in my opinion, have been able to do some small integrative steps to move forward, even if it's that one made a must that we did as it relates to looking at relatives. I mean, so we've done some things. I don't think we've done enough as it relates to really getting at some of the recommendations for the African-American disparity issue. Nationally, our model from 2001 is used. And different states have not only taken our model, they have gone beyond our model. And now I'm embarrassed because they've gone so far ahead of us in moving, trying to decrease this area of disparity. But I've been on panels, and so has folks from the department, and gone to conferences, and we get highlighted because, you know, we were one of the first catalysts to try and do something about it. My last couple questions for you is, one on the federal level, is eliminating racial disparities a performance measure for the federal review, and how that is done. And then also, have all the recommendations from the report been completed? And moving forward, what type of legislative policy changes need to be addressed here by this committee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, that's a wide open question. The disparities is not a part of the federal performance. The work on the recommendations of the 2000 report, for the most part, you know, in one way you can say it has been completed, but on the other hand, no, it's ongoing work. It's something that we need to keep part of our daily practice each and every day, whether it's the state looking at it or counties or community providers. You know, as you see here, the disparities have not gone away. It's something that we need to continue to attend to. We have seen, and I think one of the promising things that we have seen is with family assessments, the research clearly indicated that if we are able to provide services, oftentimes short-term services, to families based on what the family identifies and the family needs, we can make a difference. The family situation has improved. We have been able to prevent placement and keep kids out of the system. We also have been, research also demonstrated that that's more cost effective. Fewer families come back to the system, and for those families coming back to the system, they come back at much lower risk. And so we need to continue to be able to direct what little resources we have on the things that we know make a difference. And we know those early support and preservation services make a difference. In terms of next steps, one of the most immediate things that we are doing with the advisory committee is working with the Casey Family Foundation to hold what they call a technical assistance day, where they bring in some individuals from other states who've also had some successes working on disparities, and we hope to have that that event sometime during the summer. And Susan Alt, who's in the audience and formerly from Ramsey County, is working with Casey and is helping us to see that that happens. We will be looking at kind of, okay, what does that mean for the next steps, as well as looking at what do we know now on the data in terms of where we need to put continued efforts. In terms of legislative policy, I think one of the things that you did that was good and I think is a step in the right direction is you by statute identified family assessment as the preferred response for families. I think to the extent that you can identify preferences for providing in-home family support services to families, that is a positive thing. To the extent that we also look at what are the alternatives that ought to be in place for those children who cannot return home, and particularly thinking about kids who age out of the foster care system. We still have way too many kids aging out of the foster care system in Minnesota, and they're on their own essentially at 18 or 19. I think we need to continue to look for permanent families for those children, but also to do more work to get kids to relook at families, even after termination of parental rights, for 16, 17-year-olds that are not likely to have an opportunity for a permanent family, to really look at can they be reconnected with their birth families, whether it's their birth parents or birth relatives. Somebody who may not have been a safe parent when the child was two or three may be in a different place. And as a system, can we do more to relook and rethink about how we view adolescents now from care, and of course African American children are disproportionately in that population as well.
Thank you. Are there any other questions, members, for this testifier? If not, thank you so much for coming. And next, we have where we go from here. Irene Upsall, I hope I got that correct, Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. Please come down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Please state your name for the record and proceed.
I will do that, and I will describe a little bit initially the work I do and why I'm involved in this conversation with all of these other professionals who've been testifying before you today. My name is Irene Upsall. I'm an attorney, and I work at the Youth Law Project of the Legal Aid Society of Minneapolis. The Youth Law Project represents children in Hennepin County, and our clients fall generally into three categories. Older children who are living away from home because of abuse, neglect, or estrangement from their families. Children who've been suspended from school or are facing expulsion from school. And children under the age of 10 whose families have come to the attention of child protection because of a report of maltreatment. For decades, the Youth Law Project represented primarily older children. Many of those children had been involved with child protection as youngsters. Many of them had spent time in foster care, and we began to realize that if we represented kids earlier on when issues first surfaced in their families, we might be able to prevent problems later on. So we began about 5 years ago to represent children under 10 with the goal of ensuring that those children and their families received the help and services they needed to be safe at home and avoid the need for out-of-home placement. We continue to believe that advocacy in the early years will provide resolutions that stabilize children so they can avoid the need for representation and advocacy when they are older. We're trying to close out the part of our service that where we have so many children who are older who need legal representation because of experiences they've been through. In some ways, our work paralleled the work of Our Children, Our Future, which was an organization created in 2003 with the sole mission of reducing disparities for African American and American Indian children in the child protection system. And I believe you received a copy of their report this morning. Last November, Legal Aid's Youth Law Project took over the work of Our Children, Our Future, and focused on that work, continued that work, which was focused on community outreach to establish priorities for policy reform, to reform state and county policies and procedures that result in overrepresentation, and to provide community education on child protection basics like maltreatment reporting, what's likely, what kind of activity is child protection likely to open a case when they see it, and what families can do to help themselves and cooperate with services and help identify services that they need that would help them. In the last 5 years, we've represented hundreds of children, conducted trainings, mostly in the metropolitan area, met with community agencies, consulted with our advisory board at the Youth Law Project, and identified three strategies aimed at reducing disparities in out-of-home placement. And they are outlined on a handout that you got entitled Our Children Safe at Home Child Protection Reform Initiative. I'm going to address the first two of those priorities in a little more detail. The first priority addresses the goal of preventing entry into child protection system in the first place. We have been doing that work through representation on a child-by-child basis when children come to our office or the families come to our office and ask us to represent them. But we have identified that it might be helpful for families to establish a place for them to meet with a mediator, a lawyer, a government benefits expert to make relative care arrangements within the family before child protection gets involved. And I, both of the other speakers, I think, alluded to the fact that sometimes relatives will see a child struggling. A grandma will notice that her child is having trouble taking care of the new grandchildren and want to intervene in some way but may not know the best way to do that. And we've implemented in Hennepin County and other counties I know family group conferencing and other methods to engage the family once a child is in the system. So this effort that we're talking about now in this reform initiative is setting up sort of a similar system, but for families to access voluntarily before their cases come to the attention of Child Protective Services. These families need help understanding their legal options and help discussing those options as a family and deciding a course of action that protects the child and provides needed support and services for the parents to keep the family intact. One impediment that I want to just mention that does unfortunately involve a fiscal note probably is the impediment that's formed by the lack of affordable child care. We've represented a number of families. For instance, we represented a child whose aunt was willing to care for her while her mother went through treatment for cocaine dependency. The aunt had a stable home, but she also was working, and she couldn't afford $500 a month for child care. And so that child ends up at risk of going into out-of-home care if the family can't make that arrangement on their own. We have another client currently in non-relative foster care because the only relative willing to be a permanent option for the child is working and can't afford daycare. So that child is with strangers when the child could be with a family if we took the step of really providing what that family needed to keep that child, bring that child home, and keep that child safe at home. The second priority on the handout is to address barriers to family members who want to serve as foster parents or permanent placement options. The work is aimed at amending the maltreatment determination statutes and rules and regulations and policies that are followed by the counties. We see a number of children who remain in foster care with non-family members or who remain in the foster care system because relatives who are available are told they can't provide foster care because they have a maltreatment, for instance, a maltreatment finding on their record. Here's an example. A grandma had a maltreatment determination for slapping her daughter when the child was 16. A one-time incident, mother-teenager conflict, and although the county determined that that slap constituted maltreatment, the county also determined there was no need for services. So the grandma thought that was the end of it. Okay, you know, I lost my control, slapped my daughter, but that's the end of it now. But there was, and in fact, in this case, the girl later recanted and tried to tell the county that it was, you know, she kind of made it up because she wanted to get out of the home. But in any case, the maltreatment determination was on the grandma's record. When the grandchild, the new grandchild, ended up in the foster care system, the grandma was told that she would not be considered for placement because of the earlier finding, even though there wasn't any kind of determination that currently the grandma represented any kind of danger to her daughter or to her granddaughter. And this whole business about the effect of maltreatment determinations on the family's later opportunity to serve as a foster parent is exacerbated by racial disparities in other parts of the system. So we know from research and statistics that African American and American Indian people are more likely, for instance, to be arrested and charged with low-level offenses and end up in the correctional system or in the criminal system, and then those findings of fifth degree assault or sort of low level offenses can later on affect their ability to serve as foster parents. So there's this domino effect where racial disparity in one system exacerbates the disparity in another system, and instead of doing sort of a case-by-case analysis of whether the past is past and the relative is now competent, capable of providing a safe home for a child. A lot of us who work in the communities and who work in the county and state government have initiated attempts to affect and end the racial disparity in out-of-home placement, and each of us is working on a piece or two, and I think what was said earlier about the need to collaborate is true, and I think we've all been doing a better job at trying to work together to identify what we agree should be done, to identify maybe what our differences are about how things are going, and proceed effectively with the best interests and well-being of children in mind. But I want to, you know, I want to say that there are three or four principles that I think we need to, and you need to, and we all need to keep in mind when we're deciding on policies or activities or initiatives or pilot projects in this area. Number one, decisions about what's best for children have to take into account the importance of the family connection. And Aaron Sullivan Sutton mentioned this earlier, too, that for too long in the court system, in the child protection system, we considered only safety. And obviously, we have to consider safety, but we have to also consider whether we can accomplish safety without triggering the further trauma and injury to the child that results from separation from the family. So that's the number one overarching theme, and I think we need to keep in mind. Number two, we have to rely on the communities that are primarily affected by the disparity. African American and American Indian people, our laws in this country recognize that, you know, the rights of parents and that parents know best. Our law is sort of built on the parents know what's best for their children, and I think that we need to recognize that African American community and American Indian communities can help identify what the needs are and what the solutions are, and inform the decisions that that policymakers and legislators make on these matters. Number three, before you folks pass a piece of legislation or before county boards adopt a policy, I think that there needs to be an examination of whether that new policy or piece of legislation will ameliorate or exacerbate the disparity in out-of-home placement for African-American and American Indian children. It has to be a consideration, because too often in the past, well-meaning bodies of people have adopted legislation and policies and initiatives that have maybe inadvertent consequences that have led to this disparity. And I think we have to get a handle on really recognizing the perhaps unintended consequences of the pieces of legislation that are passed. So that concludes my remarks. Thank you very
Thank
much
you.
For allowing me to be here today.
Thank you very much also for those enlightening responses. Anyone, members, any questions for this? If not, I'm going to thank you very much and ask the next two folks to come down together. We're looking at 20 to 12 here, so we do need to move along, but we want to hear from you. Welcome, both of you, to the committee this morning, and please state your name for the tape and proceed.
Madam Chair, my name is Lynn Lewis. I'm the area manager for Hennepin County Child Protection.
Madam Chair, my name is Cindy Caesar, and I'm the manager of Child and Family Services in Anoka County Social Services.
Thank you both for being here. Please go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and get started basically looking at some of the innovations that Hennepin County has brought forward within the last couple of years to address disparity in Hennepin County. One in particular project that I'd like to discuss is a project that we call the Family Healing and Restoration Network. In 2005, we began a dialogue with African American churches over in North Minneapolis, basically asking community members and clergy, you know, how they feel about child protection, what they know about child protection, recommendations for how we can enhance our services or changes that they would recommend for our services. And we basically got an earful. We got information on how difficult our services were as far as being able to navigate through our system, not knowing how to advocate for families once they got involved with child protection, and then also looking at not necessarily a strong connection between child protection, the department, and the African-American faith community. So we began working on a relationship with the community, and we connected with a coalition of churches called His Works United. It's a coming together of the Baptist Church, Church of God in Christ, and Pentecostal Assemblies of the World. And the bishops over these three denominations basically agreed to collaborate with Hennepin County and in figuring out ways that we could work with families in a different way and develop a more robust response to meeting the needs of families that often find themselves in crisis and end up at the door of child protection. So with the Family Healing and Restoration Network, the department actually put forth dollars to fund this initiative. We were able to hire four navigators through the churches who are system responders. So when there's someone in the community that comes in off the street and needs help with identifying or locating a food shelf or locating help that may, you know, lead them into crisis, they're able to get the help that they need through the church. One of the things we're really excited about is that it's really a community-friendly, user-friendly way for people to get early help through their local churches. We're really excited about this initiative. In addition to hiring four navigators, we've also looked at our Hennepin County child protection infrastructure. So looking at ways we can strengthen our organization or enhance our organization's ability to make connections with faith-based organizations. So we're working on, right now we've identified staff that basically are throughout our organization, not just child protection, but staff from our MSIP side, our TANF side, staff that work in corrections, staff that work in children's mental health, are part of this group that basically work to be liaisons to our faith-based organizations. I'm really excited about this initiative. We're seeing some early results, we're getting positive feedback from the community as well. They're seeing another side of the department as far as being more user-friendly, more family-friendly, and really an out-of-the-box way of working with families and basically recognizing the strengths that exist within their communities. In addition to the navigators, we recently had an event at New Salem Baptist Church. It was a week-long event. We pulled together several organizations from the community, Turning Point, Crisis Nurseries, other organizations. Basically, in this week-long event, we called it the Celebration of Healing. And we collaborated with New Salem and Reverend McAfee, looking at celebrating the successes of our community. You know, I think one of the challenges that we have as systems people is that we often see the deficits that exist within our community, but we don't necessarily celebrate the strengths and the resiliencies of the families in our community. So it was a celebration looking at those folks that had success with sobriety over a period of time, that have worked themselves out of child protection, anything that the community deemed as a success. We basically joined in this celebration. And in addition to that, we worked with Mad Dads and African American Men's Project, whereas the whole week they basically canvassed the neighborhood, and anyone that wanted to get a Rule 25 assessment or wanted to get counseling, we had staff 24/7 located at New Salem, and basically we were able to provide those services around the clock. Some really interesting stories came out of that, and people walked in needing food and were able to get connected to, you know, things beyond food, but, you know, looking at some of the antecedents that got them to, you know, the states that they were in, they were able to actually get help. Early count, I think over 30 people actually were able to go in and get counseling or a Rule 25 assessment. When you talk about innovative and out-of-the-box strategies, it's really forcing the county to look at making different kinds of connections with the community. Not the traditional, you know, you come to our office for help. But it's really forcing the county to look at how we do outreach, how we connect with the community, what kind of face do we present to the community, and really recognizing the strengths and the assets that exist within the community. In addition to our faith-based collaboration, we also have a project called Fusion for Families, and it's been in existence for about 4 years, 3 or 4 years. And basically, when children are removed from the families, and if the families are on MFIP, while the children are in out-of-home placement, their infant benefits are basically cut until the children are reunified. And so it's kind of a catch-22 for families because, you know, while they're working their case plan and working towards reunification and the children are in out-of-home placement, if the children aren't in the home with them, they don't necessarily have the benefits for food, clothing, and shelter, and so they're kind of caught in this circle. One of the things we've done is that we've basically increased our connection with our TANF side, and we're working more closely with our MFIP area to support families in reunification. So whatever barriers that may be posed because children are in out-of-home placement, we really work with the TANF side to ameliorate those barriers so that families can be reunified quicker. Another promising practice that I think Aaron has already talked about is looking at family group decision-making. At Hennepin, basically, family group conferencing was offered to families when they were when we were looking at creating safety plans around permanency or reunification. one of the things we've done within the past year is developed a model called family team conferencing, where we're working with families early on before we get to the permanency stage, and we're looking at how do we create safety plans early on with families, how do we support families and in creating case plans that other family members can assist with. And so it's a way of families coming together in a unified way and determining, you know, what's best for the family and making recommendations to the court on how they want to support caring for their children. In addition to family group conferencing, we've taken it a step further. We're now looking at connecting with our faith-based partners and developing family group conferencing within faith-based settings. An even earlier response would be if a family is having challenges around raising children, or they're needing support, or they need to be pulled together to really look at how do we support one another in keeping our families strong and healthy. We want to be able to work with, you know, paraprofessionals in the community to actually provide family group conferencing facilitation to families before they get involved with child protection. I think that's one of the things we really want to look at, is how we can develop preventative strategies for families before they get to the door of child protection and really address those antecedents that lead families down that track of child protection involvement.
Thank you so much. I think we saved the best till last here. That was very, very good information. I'll take that home with me. Any questions, members? If not, would the next testifier please go ahead?
Again, I'm from Anoka County. My name is Cindy Caesar. Basically, in Anoka, you know, we were part of the study, and we've been doing a lot of work also internally looking at this issue. Back in 2003, we were looking internally at cases that were coming into the system and were opened up, for example, in child protection, income maintenance, families were on MFIP, and what we could do to try and address their needs. We decided to develop a program called Partnership for Family Success, and we didn't have any funds to do that. We basically just pulled our resources together by asking the different departments to offer a worker into this project. Mm-hmm. Many of the referrals come from MFIP, so when a family comes in to apply for that, if there are some risk factors, there's a form that they fill out that indicates that they're referring to this project. Child protection, if we receive a report that moves, for example, to assessment or otherwise, it actually opens up to a case manager, we can refer that family to this project. What they do is they provide case management to the family in the community. They will see that family and child up to 3 times a week. It's real hands-on, you know, helping the family. Let's say the mom needs a job, they'll help her secure that. You know, if she needs to learn how to ride the bus more efficiently, if she needs to have a psych eval to help her possibly get on medication, all of those things, they'll do those hands-on, you know, kinds of support. And we've been able to use that program a lot in child protection, and I told family, a worker specifically, that I want all African-American families to be referred to that project. And I believe that we've been able to get those kids home sooner if they're in out-of-home placement because of that support. The other thing that we have done is we have a parent support outreach grant. It'll unfortunately be ending the end of this year. But that project, any family that is referred into child protection that is not accepted, so they're screened out and they don't meet our criteria, if they have a child that's 10 years and under, they're referred to a worker who gives them a call, talks to them about the report, and we have 3 community providers that we can offer case management services to them. I think the unique thing about them also is they have flexible funding, which you know, has been very helpful. Many of our families may struggle with you know, paying for the rent. If they want you to get into an apartment for a deposit, for an example, if they can provide that. They may have shut-off notices. We can help with, you know, paying for those. It may be some of those little things that can kind of help, you know, keep them self-sufficient and keep that child in the home. The other thing we've done is we developed in the Human Service Division a cultural diversity training for all staff. And I was involved in that, and the first thing that we wanted to look at was African-American families. And so we had, I think it was a three-part series on that was very effective for staff. The other thing that Child Protection has done is any new officers, police officers that we have within our 13 precincts, we're offering training for them every 4 months. Basically on child protection, mandated reporting, and we've included disparities information to them. The other thing is that we also provide mandated training to all reporters, such as school personnel, medical personnel, and we've also included you know, the disparities mm-hmm. work and try to provide education on that piece. I think, you know, in our community, the biggest issue is that we have many African-American families that have come into the county from Chicago, Gary, Indiana, or even trying to leave Minneapolis and St. Paul mm-hmm. looking towards Anoka, mm-hmm. You know, for a better life. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of them, what they maybe they're faced with is that whole culture of poverty. You know, I was reading a lot of intakes that we have. They get a job, but it doesn't pay very well. Mm-hmm. They may be single parents. Daycare is very expensive. We have waiting lists for daycare assistance. And it just seems kind of cyclical where there's mm-hmm. issues around that whole poverty mm-hmm. piece and just trying to secure, you know, some of those basic things, I think, to make someone in a family successful. I think, you know, from us, for an example, we don't have a lot of service providers in Anoka, so most of our families have to go into Minneapolis, for an example. We only have one in-home provider that we're able to use, and they have to go to the cities. Well, transportation isn't great in our county. If you think about, like, Columbia Heights, you know, some of those outlining cities, you can get a bus and get into Minneapolis quite easily, but if you're in St. Francis, some of those northern, transportation is not very good.
Ms. Caesar, I'm sorry, but I'm going to have to cut you off there, and I want to thank you for all of the information that you have imparted to us, and I appreciate hearing from you and from all of you. I thought it was very educational, very informative. We do have to get out of here. The next committee is here and ready to go to work, so I want to thank goodness Representative Walker is back, because I want to thank her for bringing this informational hearing to us this morning. Thank you, Representative Walker. And
real quick.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually will listen to the audio from the counties and probably do a follow-up letter to the counties and to the department. Again, I want to thank you for caring and Representative Thiessen for letting us put something on record. I do have many more questions that I didn't get to. However, I had to go to finance, and they came and got me at the wrong time. But I just want to say, members, just for the record, that this is an important issue that impacts so many of our families across the state. And fiscally, mm-hmm. it's costing us some money that could have been avoided if we would have switched where we put that priority around policy and prevention first. And so I'm hoping that we'll be able to do some follow-up in the coming years and be a little bit more aggressive on how to decrease this disparity that we have. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Walker. And before we leave, we need to move the minutes, Ms. Loft, Representative Loft.
I'm happy to move the minutes.
Okay.
For Tuesday, April 22nd.
So moved and agreed upon. Good. Minutes are moved and the meeting is over.